Freunde, wenn ihr das also macht, müsst ihr eine Sache machen. Dann müsst ihr eine Sache
So, the past 3 weeks, more or less, I've been talking about Kant's aesthetics, and Kant's aesthetics and Deleuze's relationship to it. Okay, everything okay there?
Yeah,
good. All right, so we reached the conclusion that Deleuze took two very important elements from Kant. These elements are, first of all, what Deleuze calls Kant's genius, which is the method of immanent critique. This is the process by which each faculty by which reason itself examines itself to find its own condition. Each critique finds different conditions, the conditions of the understanding, the conditions of reason, and the conditions of judgment. So Deleuze is going to follow a version of Kant's critique. He's going to follow a version of immanent critique that obviously is introduced into the history of philosophy by Kant, and this is precisely the importance. Perhaps if we could just leave it at the back, and when people come in, we could give them a copy. And Deleuze is also going to take from Kant the results of this immanent critique, which is the discovery and the exploration of a transcendental realm. So Deleuze is a kind of transcendental philosopher in the tradition of Kant. But there are some very significant differences between them that I'm going to start talking about much more today, because today is going to be about Nietzsche. And for Deleuze, Nietzsche offers a kind of, not exactly, let's say, a corrective, but perhaps a way in which the problems with Kant's critique can be overcome. Okay? I'm going to talk much more about that today. Okay, so that's the first element of Kant that Deleuze takes and uses for himself, the immanent critique and the transcendental realm that it reveals. The second element that Deleuze is very drawn to in Kant, I've talked about this before, that is this sublime experience that he finds in the third critique. And Deleuze is going to take this sublime experience. Remember, an experience that Deleuze located in the emergence of rhythm from chaos. I talked about that last week. Deleuze is going to take this experience of the sublime and basically make it, normative is not the right word, but let's say the fundamental criteria for whatever it is that is going to be called art by Deleuze. Obviously, this is something I'm going to talk a lot more about as we go through the course, but today I'm going to talk a bit about how Deleuze massages this concept of the sublime that he takes from Kant through Nietzsche. So he's going to use Nietzsche to kind of make this concept of the sublime more usable for him. And the main way that he's going to do that is to try and separate the concept of the sublime from its romanticism. Okay, he's going to use Nietzsche to do this. Now, I hope there'll be enough time for me to talk about this at the end of the class today. All right, so we've got these two aspects. Immanent critique, transcendental realm, this being the first, and the sublime. And I'm going to try and talk about these two elements today in relationship to Nietzsche and to Deleuze's reading of Nietzsche. Nietzsche now is the first of what Deleuze calls, perhaps slightly ironically, his Holy Trinity, which is Nietzsche, Spinoza, and Bergson. And those are going to be, in fact, the next three lectures that I'm going to do, Nietzsche, Spinoza, and Bergson. All right, but what I want to start with today is someone that I mentioned previously without really talking about their importance, and that is another German idealist philosopher who's not really so well known in terms of the canon, let's say, but was very important for Deleuze, and that is a philosopher whose name is Salomon Maimon. Now, Maimon wrote a critique of Kant that was published after the second critique, but before the third critique had been published. And it was a critique that Kant read, and Kant said in response that it was that Maimon was the only one who had truly understood me, which is an interesting comment considering that Maimon had actually launched quite a strong critique of the Kantian system. But many people point out, Deleuze being one of them, that in fact the third critique seems to anticipate in many ways the critiques of Maimon. So Kant was already working on the third critique when he read Maimon's critique. So it's not to say that he responded directly to Maimon's criticisms, but it's to say perhaps that Kant himself was thinking down the same lines that Maimon was also critiquing Kant on, and that was fundamentally the problem of how the accord of the faculties, how this is produced. This is what I talked about last week in relationship to the third critique, that Kant sees there as being a problem that he has to actually explain how it is that the particular falls under the general universal concept. Yeah? This is the role of judgment. And so this process of judgment has to somehow be explained before you can go on to talk about the relationship of the ideas or the a priori concepts to empirical experience. So Kant realizes that he somehow got it the wrong way around, and that now he has to explain actually how there is this relationship in the first place. And this is precisely the thrust of Maimon's critique of Kant's system. Maimon argued that although the conditions of possible experience explain the facts of knowledge and morality, in other words, the kind of everyday empirical facts of what I know and what I do. So although the conditions of possible experience explain these, it assumes these facts to be true rather than shows how reason produces them. Okay, this is this problem that Kant himself had an awareness of, is that, well, he's already assumed the structure of reason, and then he has to try, then he wants to show how reason, or what the conditions of reason are. But those are the very conditions that are anyway determining his own project. So the question becomes, well, how do those themselves emerge? Maimon argues that what is needed is a genetic method. This is exactly what Deleuze also argues in one of the articles that I included in the Reader.
A genetic what? Sorry.
genetic method. The genetic method, yeah. So this comes from Maimon. Maimon argues that what is needed is a genetic method to show how the a priori facts of reason are themselves produced by reason. A genetic deduction would seek the real and absolutely immanent conditions of experience rather than simply experiences conditions of possibility. Maimon argued that the conditions of possible experience are designed to explain and are therefore modeled on empirical experience. And as a result, these conditions form a transcendental subject that is simply a reflection of the thinking subject. For those of you maybe who have studied some Heidegger, you'll know this is a similar argument to the one that Heidegger makes against the first critique, which is that Kant produces an analysis of empirical experience designed to show its transcendental conditions of possibility. But because these conditions are already, let's say, built in to experience itself, all it can ever do is reproduce, let's say, subjective experience on a transcendental level. Yeah? And this is, I mentioned it in passing sometimes before, this is a very similar problem to what Deleuze is going to find with phenomenology. Yeah? The phenomenological transcendental subjectivity is simply a kind of a repeat on a higher level of an actual empirical subjectivity. So what is meant to explain empirical experience, transcendental conditions of possibility of any possible experience, what is meant to explain empirical experience is in fact modeled on it. And this has to itself be explained. This was already the problem that Deleuze found so fascinating in the sublime. Although Kant finds the ideas through sublime experience, this does not solve the problem of their genesis, of the genesis of the ideas, of how the ideas themselves emerge. Deleuze, on the other hand, showed that sublime aesthetic experiences reveal their genesis in chaos and the rhythms that emerge from it. This rhythmical chaos is the real condition of experience and is what Deleuze will explore in terms of a transcendental realm of differential relations. As I mentioned this last week, we're starting to talk now about this very important distinction in Deleuze between the virtual and the actual. So this transcendental realm of differential relations, which is going to be the virtual, whose repetition, as he calls it in Difference and Repetition, his repetition, the repetition of these virtual differential relations in the actual world, in the actual, in empirical experience, this is always going to be a productive process that ends up with something new. And in effect, this was also one of the important thrusts of Maimon's critique, which is that if the conditions of possible experience are already given in the first place, then how can anything new appear within the, let's say, rational structure of the human being? That everything is already somehow decided beforehand. Yeah? Even when, in the case of the sublime, experience exceeds the possibility or the conditions of its own possibility, it nevertheless, let's say, is redeemed by this higher power of the ideas that then emerge and, let's say, save my subjectivity from its dispersal. Deleuze is going to want to find a kind of, let's say, through the process of critique, he wants to find the process of individuation or coming into being, let's say, in which there is no pre-existing conditions. That the conditions and what the conditions produce, the conditioned, are immanent to each other. Yeah? that they are forming the same, as Deleuze calls it, plane of immanence. Okay, I'm going to try and explain what this might be as we go along today. All right. So as I said, in this sense, Deleuze clearly follows Kant in pursuing a transcendental philosophy, but he does so seeking the real conditions of actual experience, which, as Maimon had already shown, must lie in the ontological principle of difference. The problem in Kant, according to Maimon, is that if both the conceptual conditions for possible experience and the conditions for moral action found in reason are universal determinations external to what they determine, then the transcendental is reduced to a simple conditioning, and its own genesis remains unable to be thought. In other words, if the conditions lie outside what it is they are conditioning, then there remains the question as to where these conditions themselves come from. Yeah? But that's exactly the problem of Kant's process, of the process of critique, is that he has to already assume those external conditions to even begin to think about the conditions of thinking. So he's kind of locked in to the structure from the very beginning. Yeah? And this is why the problem of genesis is so important, because the question that Maimon wants to ask is, well, where do these conditions come from in the first place? You can't just say that we find these conditions by examining empirical experience in order to find their immanent conditions, because these immanent conditions have had to have already been assumed before you even began the process of examining the empirical information in the first place. Yeah? So this is the problem of genesis. Where does this external difference between the conditions and the conditioning come from? What's the genesis of this external difference? Okay. So what is not thought here is the relation, and so also the difference, between the transcendental conditions and the empirical condition. This is a crucial point where Deleuze departs from Kant, and as we shall see, it's on this point that he's going to embrace or use Nietzsche. For Kant, critique aims at discovering the transcendental principles that are a priori and absolutely true, and are the conditions of reason. But this, as I've said, is a kind of vicious circle, as Deleuze slightly sarcastically points out. He says, critique must be a critique of reason by reason itself. Yeah? So, if you like, reason is both the judge and the accused, yeah? All at the same time. This means the conditions of reason lie in its own assumed structure that acts as a limit to, rather than the possibility of, an inquiry into how these conditions emerged in the first place. So, I'm just going to say, actually, these conditions now, they've become a kind of a limit on the project of critique. That critique is limited by its own assumption of these conditions. Yeah? And so that even when it tries to, let's say, find these conditions, the conditions are already there in its own structure and process of inquiry. All right, so Deleuze puts it quite clearly in his book on Nietzsche. This is the first quotation.
How is Deleuze positioning his critique himself, when he says that critique is a critique of itself, how can he position himself in this critique of the critique of the critique?
Well, he's going to do it. You'll just have to wait a little while, because I'm going to go on and explain this. The question about how does Deleuze position himself is another interesting question, which I've sort of mentioned a few times, which is that it's pretty difficult to say what Deleuze himself, what his position might be, without already talking about the philosophers that he is reading. So that's why, in order to understand what Deleuze's position is, we have to understand how it is exactly that he understands Kant and then Nietzsche and then the other figures that he examines. So it's never so simple as just to say, what is Deleuze's position in connection in relation to Kant and in relationship to Nietzsche? Because Deleuze's position is already in some respects Kantian, but in other respects Nietzschean. And so it's precisely this kind of relation which is what is going to produce, yeah, some kind of philosophical movement, some kind of position is maybe not quite correct, because it's entirely implicated in the philosophers that he's reading. Nevertheless, it's possible to say some things he's more interested in than others, some things he emphasizes, other things he rejects. So it's an interested reading, let's say. Yeah? I'm going to talk more about that today, because it's exactly what he sees Nietzsche is offering him in terms of his critique, is precisely this explanation of a kind of a real relation to the process and to the conditions. So interpretation is going to become a kind of ontological term for Deleuze through Nietzsche, because it's going to give this element. Well, okay, I'm going to talk about that later. We'll wait until we get to it. All right. The first quotation on the page of quotations, this is from Deleuze's book on Nietzsche. This is written more or less around the same time as the book on Kant. Kant does not realize his project of immanent critique. Transcendental philosophy discovers conditions which still remain external to the conditioned. Transcendental principles are principles of conditioning and not of internal genesis. We require a genesis of reason itself, and also a genesis of the understanding and its categories. Okay, so I'm going to try and explain today how Deleuze uses Nietzsche exactly as a kind of corrective to Kant, and able to bring about a truly immanent form of critique. But before I do that, I just want to finish talking about how Deleuze, following Maimon, wants reason to explain how it in fact produced its conditions, rather than simply how we obey them. As I said before, it requires a principle of difference as the real condition of experience, because it is precisely in the difference between condition and conditioned that the genesis of reason takes place. It's precisely this difference between the transcendental conditions of possible experience and empirical experience itself, the conditioned. It's precisely in this difference itself that must be explained. It's somewhere in, let's say, the depths of this difference that a principle has to be found that is going to explain their production. You have to explain the genesis, to explain how, in fact, they came about in the first place. So this is exactly what Deleuze, following Maimon, says that Kant cannot do with his system as it stands. In other words, what has to be explained by critique is the difference between transcendental conditions and the empirical conditioned, such that their external and still assumed difference can become an internal and genetic difference. If the question of critique is what gives the given, and the answer is that the given is the difference between empirical and transcendental faculties, which would seem to be the answer that Kant gives, then we must seek to discover the genetic principle of this given difference, a principle that cannot be found in the a priori identities of concepts and ideas, but that must be found in difference itself. So this is the emergence now of difference as a kind of ontological principle, which is going to inform all of Deleuze's philosophy. In doing so, we move from an external difference between the conditions and the conditioned, which would be Kant's form of the given, to an internal difference between reciprocally determined genetic elements. Okay, if the difference is internal, it means the difference must be reciprocally determining. It means that you cannot have simply a determination from one to the other, yeah? Because otherwise the difference will retain an externality. Yeah? It must be moving in both directions, a reciprocal determination, yeah, for the difference to be truly internal and immanent. Here, difference, this is basically the, let's say, target of all of Deleuze's philosophy, difference becomes the real condition of real experience. Yeah? It's not the condition of all possible experience. Yeah? It's a real condition of real experience. Okay, we'll try and see what that might mean. Okay, I started to talk about this a bit last time, and now I'm going to try and extend it. Deleuze seeks the real conditions of experience not in transcendent ideas, not in transcendent ideas. You remember the difference. A transcendent idea is one that lies outside of the system that it determines. So he's not interested in transcendent ideas, but in what he calls, again, various names, but often virtual ideas or problematic ideas. Now we remember this is another instance of Deleuze's ventriloquism, because he finds the term problematic ideas in Kant himself, in fact, but he's going to push it in a direction which goes, let's say, well beyond the scope of Kant, or at least so Deleuze would argue. Okay, these problems are differential rather than identical in nature, and are defined by variable differences such as warm, cold, dark, light, or figure, ground, to talk, let's say, just to take some aesthetic examples that I'm going to come back to later on in the course. Okay, why are they virtual? Okay, they're virtual because obviously they have no actuality in themselves. Yeah? Warm, cold, it's not a thing. Yeah? It's a virtual entity or idea that is actualized in a thing. Yeah? So a thing is more or less warm or cold. Yeah? So in other words, the warmth or the cold of an actual object is an actualization of a tension or virtual difference between these terms, warm, cold. Yeah? Now these problems, warm, cold, dark, light, figure, ground, enter into relations forming virtual multiplicities that are actualized in the world as temporary resolutions. Deleuze and Guattari will also call them rhythms or refrains, of their founding difference in a local appearance. Okay, this means that these virtual differences, yeah, they enter into relations on the virtual plane, or on the transcendental plane, if you like. Yeah. So, in other words, any object is not simply the actualization of warm, cold. Yeah, it's the actualization of warm, cold, and of solid fluid, of a whole series of virtual differences that have formed a multiplicity which is as singular as the actual object which expresses that multiplicity. Okay, this is starting to move now towards what it means to say real conditions of real experience. Yeah? A real experience, a singular particular experience of an empirical object, yeah, contains its own specific and singular transcendental conditions, yeah, which, as I'm going to try and go on to explain, have in fact been reciprocally determined, yeah, that the actual and the virtual are reciprocally determined. It's not simply a one-way virtual condition, actual conditioned. Yeah? In other words, there is no external difference. The difference is entirely internal to experience. Yeah? Alright, let's see if we can get our heads around that. The virtual differences or ideas that act as the real conditions of the actual are not unchanging and eternal, nor universal, because they are in relations of reciprocal determination with each other that are just as particular as their actual expressions. Deleuze quotes Maimon on this point. This is the next quote now. So this is Maimon being quoted by Deleuze in Difference and Repetition. A particular object is the result of the particular rule of its production or the mode of its differential, and the relations between different objects results from the relations between their differentials. We can think of a simple example from art. A particular reciprocal determination of the dark light and figure ground differentials produce a particular painting, no doubt in combination with other differentials. What counts is the singularity of this particular differential multiplicity, which produces its actualized expression. A difference in one difference, as it were, would produce an entirely different painting. So even though we can say, as in fact many art historians have argued, for example, Heinrich Wulfflin, who's going to be an important influence on Deleuze, German art historian of the 19th century, that you can understand painting through the development of certain differential relations. So light and shadow, line and colour, figure and ground, these are kind of, let's say, abstract conditions for painting. Drawing, yeah, which have been explored through long and very different periods of art development. Yeah. So there is a kind of a consistency to these problems, but there is, let's say, a history of these problems' actualization, which itself is going to feed back into new expressions or constructions of the virtual differential, yeah, that there will be a kind of reciprocal determination between history and something which escapes history, which is new, yeah, and that it's precisely this relation which is this reciprocal determination. The actual is has its virtual conditions, but the virtual conditions are themselves determined by the actual expressions, by their actual expressions. For example, the virtual differential relation of figure ground is not the same in Egyptian art as it is in Malevich's white square on white. Even though we could say that figure ground is, let's say, the crucial problem for both, at least Deleuze will argue that in the Bacon book, meaning the ongoing series of actual artworks that this virtual differential, that both expresses this virtual differential and constructs a certain kind of historically changing conception of the differential itself. So you have the Egyptian instantiation of the figure ground differential. You have, let's say, Russian constructivism's exploration of the figure ground differential. And along this trajectory, yeah, the nature or the question or the problem of figure ground has itself been changed. Yeah? So that there is this reciprocal determination. The problem remains transcendental. It remains virtual. Yeah? Figure ground. It's this problem which has, we could say, haunted, yeah, a certain form of art for its entire history. But what this figure ground relationship is, or could be, the ways in which it could be expressed, in fact, have changed, and this has in turn changed the nature of the differential itself, and of course also its various differential relations to other differences. Yeah? There have been other multiplicities that have emerged, multiplicities which have fallen away. If we think of Egyptian art, we can't possibly comprehend it simply through the virtual difference of figure ground. We have to place this differential in relationship to various other ones that may come from, you know, religious ideas, funerary art, so forth and so on, which clearly, yeah, are no longer in contact with the figure ground, or are no longer part of the figure ground problem. And other things have emerged into what Deleuze and Guattari will call the abstract machine of the figure ground. Sometimes they call it a diagram. Yeah, there are these the different diagrams that are congealing and dissolving, yeah, between these various virtual relations. This means that the transcendental virtual plane is, after Maimon, understood as the plane of real conditions and is inseparable from its plane of actualization, the plane of real experience. This will mean a fundamental shift in Deleuze's use of Kant, a shift from a Kantian transcendental idealism to a Deleuzean transcendental materialism. Nietzsche will help Deleuze to explore this transcendental, but nevertheless real, realm of production through his concept of the will to power. Alright, so finally I'm going to get on to Nietzsche. So I'm going to talk about, as I mentioned before, firstly Nietzsche's ontology, particularly will to power, eternal return. And I'm going to talk about Nietzsche's interest in art, its connection to the concept of the Dionysian, and the way in which the Dionysian is going to help Deleuze, let's say, remove the romanticism from the concept of the sublime that he takes from Kant. Hopefully, if I have time. All right. The concepts of will to power and eternal return are crucial to Deleuze's philosophy at a very fundamental level, not least in the way they allow him to extend Kant's critical project to an examination of the real conditions of real experience. Deleuze writes, this is the next quotation. In fact, it's more or less just the extension of the first quotation. Transcendental principles are principles of conditioning and not of internal genesis. This is Deleuze talking about Kant. We require a genesis of reason itself, what Deleuze takes from Maimon, and also a genesis of the understanding and its categories, what are the forces of reason and of the understanding. What is the will which hides and expresses itself in reason? What stands behind reason in reason itself? In the will to power and the method which derives from it, Nietzsche has at his disposal a principle of internal genesis. So, clearly, Deleuze sees Nietzsche as, let's say, the extension of the Kantian critical project, but let's say its extension beyond and through the criticisms that were made of it by Maimon. So, how does this work? Nietzsche understands everything whether it is politics, psychology, or art, as signs for relations of force. Everything is a symptom that expresses relations of force. Everything actual expresses these virtual forces. I'm putting a Deleuzean kind of a gloss on it now, but this is more or less the direction it's going in. Okay, these relations of force have two fundamental elements. The first constitutes the force in itself, as it were, and the second constitutes our experience of that force. Okay, so there is the force and there is our experience of the force. Okay, these are the two basic elements. These are the two basic elements that are going to explain the relations between forces, which is the active element. Yeah, that's what makes things happen. Okay, the force itself, if such a thing can be said of a force, the force itself is constituted through its difference from other forces. This is why it's difficult to say a force itself, because the force is actually the production of a difference between forces. We'll get onto this. This is important. So each force encompasses a series of transcendental differences that at their fullest extent include all the forces of the universe. Okay, this is a kind of a differential logic, if you like. Precisely its ontological nature, right? If each force is a difference between two forces, then those two forces are themselves constituted of a difference of forces, and so on and so forth, out to the point of encompassing all of the forces that exist. Yeah? Which means that any given force is an expression of, to put it very shortly, everything. Yeah? This is a very fundamental element of an immanent ontology. It means that any single thing is going to be an expression at, let's say, its broadest level of extension of everything else. This is going to be a recurring theme in the course, because it's going to be the basis of Spinoza's ontology. It's also going to be the basis of Bergson's ontology. It's exactly this element that Deleuze picks up on and kind of connects across very different philosophies. It's hard for us to imagine now, or maybe it's not so hard to imagine here in Vienna philosophy department, but in fact, you know, when Deleuze came out with this kind of connection of philosophers, it was a very much a kind of a new tradition that he had invented, more or less, yeah, by focusing on this ontological element, this kind of ontology of immanence, and finding the way in which, and seeing the way in which certain important philosophers in the history of philosophy, and some not so important, like Maimon, for example, the way that they shared this kind of interest or exploration of transcendental materialism or immanent ontology, this was a new thing that Deleuze produced. Yeah? So people hadn't really thought of this kind of philosophical tradition before Deleuze. Deleuze, let's say, in a certain way, invents his own history. Yeah? So he puts himself at the end of this long philosophical development, coming from, you know, the pre-Socratics, the Stoics, it takes in the Atomists, Lucretius, and so forth and so on, Dunscotus, through, you know, all of the famous names that are rolled up into it, Leibniz, Spinoza, Nietzsche, Bergson, and so forth and so on. And then at the end of it is Deleuze, and in effect, Deleuze created his own tradition. And this is kind of the ultimate and the broader scope of this ventriloquism that I've been talking about, is that it's not just that Deleuze makes the philosophers he reads into new philosophers, but by doing so, he actually constructs a new tradition of philosophy. And this has been enormously influential, because we see now the way that people, contemporary philosophers, are extremely interested in trying to do this. And so maybe the most relevant example for us is Alain Badiou, who now wants to say, yes, okay, so that means that Deleuze marks the end of a certain tradition and I mark the beginning of a new one. Yeah, so this kind of way of doing philosophy, I think, has really changed a lot of things in terms of contemporary philosophy. But we'll come to that at the end when I talk about Badiou in more detail.
Excuse me. Isn't it just postmodern thinking? I think this is what the postmodern thinking describes exactly.
Why is it postmodern?
I think that this deconstruction of history and the deconstruction of the strings of history is very postmodern, and that's what Deleuze did.
It's not. What Deleuze does is it's not deconstruction in a technical sense. It's not connected to that.
Okay.
I mean, it's a good question, so I want to answer it, but I'm just trying to think how I can answer it really shortly so that we don't get too distracted. If we think of Derrida as being, you know, the philosopher of deconstruction, I'm by no means an expert about Derrida, please, so you don't have to take what I say as being necessarily true. But if the end point of deconstruction is basically to show us that there is a difference that is genetic or that is productive, this difference in itself remains without positive terms. Yeah? So that means that the process of deconstruction is going to reveal how there is a foundational difference which in itself is not positive. It's an ontological position. Yeah? So it means that, you know, there are all of these metaphors for this moment in Derrida. You know, you have the trace, you have difference, you have, the paragon. I mean, there are so many of them. Right? But in the end, what is this difference? Yeah? It's the kind of foundation, non-foundation of anything. Yeah, this very Heideggerian moment, which is a kind of, this is why I call it a difference without positive terms, because it's simply a kind of a grounding difference beyond which you can go no further. Yeah? Now that's, okay, there's considerable argument about this, I have to say, so my opinion is not the only one in this regard. But I would regard Deleuze's concept of difference as being quite different from Derrida's in this regard, because it is a real condition, which means that it is never a kind of an abstract difference. It's always a difference. Even if it's virtual, it's a difference between something. You can't just say, to just say difference in the context of Deleuze, it's meaningless. It has no meaning. Yeah? It has what difference? That's exactly the point. What is that difference? That's what the whole engagement with Kant's critical philosophy is all about. It's all about trying to get beyond this kind of, you know, taken for granted difference between the condition and the condition. It's to actually make it real. Yeah? To make the difference real. So in other words, to give it positive terms. This is also the real problem that Deleuze has with Hegel, for example, is that difference, yeah, is never a positive term. It's always understood as travelling through negation.
Okay. Now, the so it stays open for Derrida and it's not open for Deleuze. Is this what
no, it's
saying?
Well, I think that what Deleuze would say is that the openness in Derrida was finally, in the end, non-productive. That you get down to this kind of bottom level and you're just in this constant, you find a space of constant differentiation, which is not in itself something. So there is a transcendental level there as well, and this would be exactly the point at which some people would argue that there are strong similarities between Derrida and Deleuze, because in Derrida's system, difference is also a transcendental term. But in the Deleuzean system, difference is always a positive term, and it's always a real difference. Yeah? So this would be the sense in which I would say, but as I said, there are books about the similarities between Deleuze and Derrida, so it's just my opinion, there are other ones as well. In relationship to postmodernism, I mean, again, we have to talk about what is postmodernism, but without getting into that very complicated question, I would just say that there are very, very specific and extraordinarily angry remarks by both Deleuze and Guattari against postmodernism. So maybe there'll be time to talk more about this when I come to the lecture on Guattari or so, because he was especially vehement in this regard. But they both regarded postmodernism as being a kind of capitulation, a political capitulation. So for both of them, postmodernism marked a kind of an ending of commitment. And this was an enormous problem for them. This was a reason for their anger. It was more of a, it's more of a political anger than a kind of a philosophical anger, because they saw postmodernism as being the kind of beginning of the hegemony of irony, yeah, and this kind of a kind of relativism without any kind of philosophical rigor. So maybe we can talk more about that as we go along. All right, where were we? Okay, so a force is a difference between two forces, which means that effectively the universe is constituted by ramifying relationships of forces that at their fullest extent will encompass everything that is. This is going to be basically what Spinoza is going to call God or nature. Yeah? Every individual mode is going to be an expression of substance. Substance is going to be God and nature. Okay, we'll get to that next week. All right, now these relations between forces are of two types. There are active or reactive forces. An active force overcomes those forces that it is in relationship to, and a reactive force attempts to resist such an overcoming. In this sense, every force has a value. It's either active or reactive. And it is this value which gives for Nietzsche the force's expression by a thing its meaning. So a thing gets its meaning through the nature of its value. Is it an active or reactive force? Does it overcome the forces it comes into contact with, or does it try and prevent, yeah, its own overcoming? So you have to remember that an active force, yeah, it's not a force that stays the same in overcoming another force. In other words, it doesn't absorb the other force into itself, yeah, and remain the same. That overcoming another force means, in fact, overcoming one's own form. So that an active force is a force that changes. Yeah? Even though it's the force that overcomes, it doesn't just sort of stay the same while it overcomes something else. The process of overcoming necessarily means a change in itself. For Nietzsche, active force is the fundamental force of life and is the force that is always in a state of becoming, of growth, and of increase. This living force of overcoming is what Nietzsche calls the will to power, which is not a will for power, but the living power of life to always become more than it already is. In other words, the process of overcoming, the process of increase, is a process by which a thing is going to change. The will to power is, Nietzsche writes in Zarathustra, the unexhausted procreative will of life. Every living thing, he writes in his notebooks, does everything it can not to preserve itself, but to become more. Yeah? So to preserve yourself is the reactive mode. It is to prevent activity, to prevent change and transformation, to prevent overcoming. This means that these relationships of forces, these differential relationships of forces, active or reactive, encompass, and this is why the will to power is an ontological principle, it encompasses everything. Yeah? Nietzsche writes, this world is the world will to power and nothing besides. And you yourselves are also this will to power and nothing besides. This nothing besides is very important because this is clearly a direct comment, let's say, on not just Kant, but anyway, for us, Kant, right? Because in Kant, there remains something besides. There is this world, and then there is something besides. Yeah? Whereas in Nietzsche, there is the will to power, which is a virtual differential set of relations between forces, a transcendental condition of the real, but this condition is itself real and in the world. It is not existing outside of the world. There is nothing besides. So there is genesis. Yeah? There is the genesis of the world, of experience, a genesis which is, let's say, located and occurs on a transcendental virtual plane of will to power, but this will to power is nothing but the world. There is no virtual realm that exists outside of its actualization. The virtual is the actual, just as the actual reciprocally determines the virtual. There is nothing besides, there is only the world. This is that precisely this, what I mentioned before, this transcendental materialism. Yeah? Everything is material, but within the material world, there remains, as part of that world, yeah, as in fact the genetic part of that world. This is where Bergson is going to use the term élan vital. Yeah? This kind of, there is this genetic element, this element which creates the world and creates it new, which Nietzsche calls will to power, which Deleuze calls the virtual, yeah? And which is precisely what creates the world new, but which is nothing but the world. Yeah? Okay, this is this idea of immanence. This is this idea of an immanent ontology, a plane of immanence. All right. So, despite everything being will to power, there is still within the will to power reactive forces that attempt to preserve themselves, and which do so by negating the will to power. This is what Nietzsche calls nihilism. It's a hatred for life and a will to nothingness. This is not something other than will to power, but it's like a kind of an instantiation of the will to power that attempts to, let's say, resist its own tendency towards overcoming. And it's this nihilism, this negating, this negative force, reactive force, that is going to be precisely the realm of the human. So it's going to be humanity, which is precisely the, let's say, realm of life, which is going to found itself and sustain itself on reactive, reactive forces and nihilism. It's nihilism because, as Nietzsche puts it, it's a hatred for life. So, in order to sustain ourselves as human beings, we actually have to negate the power of overcoming, which is the power of life. We have to prevent overcoming and will to power perpetuating itself. Yeah? We have to react against those forces in order to preserve humanity. And we have lots of different ways of doing it that Nietzsche examines in a great deal of detail. But, of course, for whom morality is going to be one of the most important mechanisms as well as God. Obviously, God and morality being very closely connected. The thing about God is that God tends to project a rationale or a justification for humanity outside of life. And so it's a kind of an external guarantor of the necessity and the importance of humanity. And this is going to be why, for Nietzsche, the death of God is going to be such an important philosophical move. Okay, but I'm not really going to talk about that today. All right. So, we've got these two types of forces. We've got active forces, we've got reactive forces. And Nietzsche argues, this is the next quotation, every individual may be regarded as representing the ascending or descending line of life. When one has decided which, one has thereby established a canon for the value of his egoism. Okay, so we express the ascending or the descending line of life. We express active will to power when we affirm and enable the overcoming not only of ourselves but of other things. This is precisely going to be the process that moves towards the Übermensch. Yeah? This is the overcoming of the human itself. Or, if we're more normal people, we are reactive, nihilist, and negating. We regard ourselves as being the center of the universe. We regard humanity as being the most important species, and so forth and so on. And we attempt to do everything we can to try and keep it like that. But what is important about this quotation, and I kind of put it into block letters, is that the crucial element contributing to the value of forces appears as interpretation. Right? So it means that it's not just that we are either active or reactive. It's that we can decide which we are. In other words, there is a kind of a process of interpretation which is necessary and integral to the appearance of any force as being active or reactive. Yeah? So in other words, there is no position outside by which we can judge. I mean, that's actually the implications of Nietzsche's attack on morality, is that there is no kind of external standard of judgment by which we can say this force is active or this force is reactive. Yeah? We can only decide for ourselves through our own interpretation whether this force will become active or whether this force will become reactive. So we are never apart from what it is that we engage with and that we think about. The value of force is not understood as a pre-existing truth. Such a position would once more establish the separation of conditions from the condition. This is exactly what we're trying to avoid. Instead, the value of a force is established by the interpretation of the things that actualize them. So forces are actualized in things, in objects. And it is our interpretation or relationship to those things which will itself actualize a force, which will be active or reactive. It is our interpretation of things that give them an active or reactive value, and this is why Deleuze finds in Nietzsche the culmination of transcendental critique, because interpretation not only expresses its real conditions, it effectively creates them. Interpretation is a perspective, as Nietzsche calls it, within which a thing appears and which determines its active or reactive value. So there is a perspective, which is a relation that is itself formed of relations. And this perspective is either in a relation, in an active relation with the forces that it encompasses, in other words, in a relation of overcoming, or it is in a reactive relation to these forces, which attempts to preserve their existence as they are. Yeah? But the question still remains, what determines this interpretation? In other words, what is it that determines whether we have an active or a reactive relationship to things in the world? Our interpretation is itself determined. This is now Deleuze's reading of Nietzsche. Okay, so this is the beginning of his book on Nietzsche, which is called Critique, in fact. It's another example of, it's a very convincing reading of Nietzsche, but, you will struggle to find Nietzsche ever articulating the argument in the way that Deleuze articulates it. That's not surprising, because Nietzsche is such a singular philosophical author, who's writing in such strange and poetic styles, so the normal form of argumentation is sometimes not actually present in Nietzsche himself, so that also has to be taken into consideration. But anyway, this question of interpretation and what I'm going to call evaluation, this is Deleuze's reading now of Nietzsche. So, our interpretation is itself determined by an affirmative or negative evaluation of will to power, what Nietzsche will also call the revaluation of value. It is when we affirm the active forces in a thing that we are able to overcome ourselves in an expression of will to power, and when we negate these forces, they turn reactive and simply reaffirm what is all the small moral values determined by God and which forms the human all too human in God's image. Okay, so we have our interpretation of a force as being active or reactive. But this interpretation is itself formed by what Deleuze calls an evaluation, which is an affirmation or a negation of will to power itself. Now, it's very important, this distinction, even though at first it appears a little bit ambiguous as to what precisely the distinction might be, but we can think of it as being the way in which Nietzsche articulates, or we can say Deleuze/Nietzsche, articulates the culmination of the critical project in the formula real conditions, real experience. So if you have our interpretation of a thing or a force as being active or reactive, we can understand this as being the real experience. Okay, that is our experience. But what are the conditions of this experience? The conditions of this experience are our evaluation, yeah, which is the affirmation or negation of will to power, which, let's say, is already the conditions itself. So, because will to power is, in fact, affirmation or negation, active or reactive, so the moment of evaluation is the moment where the conditions become inseparable and, in fact, indeterminable from, let's say, the experience that they condition. Yeah? These are these two moments by which the conditions and the conditioned come together. Interpretation is a perspective, as Nietzsche calls it, within which a thing appears and which determines its active or reactive value. Oh, sorry, I read that before. Okay. Okay, this means, And this is no doubt one of the most beautiful elements of Nietzsche's philosophy, that thinking is not about discovering its conditions, as if these truths existed outside of existence. Thought is instead dedicated to creating new conditions, new values, which unleash life or will to power wherever it is negated. So this is going to be one of the strongest elements that Deleuze takes from Nietzsche, which is that thought is not about understanding conditions that pre-exist experience, but it is a pre-exist life, in fact, but is about creating new conditions for life. Right? It's to create new possibilities for life. It's also going to be a constant refrain in Deleuze's work. It's going to be the way that Deleuze kind of summarizes Foucault's Nietzscheanism, the exploration or the discovery of new forms of life or new possibilities of life. And in doing this, this is another super important philosophical point. This is the way for Deleuze that being equals thought. Now, this is the great holy grail, if you like, for so many philosophers, especially German idealist philosophers. How is being the same as thought? How is thought equal to being and being equal to thought? Well, Deleuze finds in Nietzsche this kind of beautiful, imminent but very vitalist, very kind of vitalist in the sense of living a nature philosophy, which is what Deleuze and Guattari together are going to try to kind of, again, very perversely resuscitate here. This is the kind, its meaning is that to think is to, let's say, embody a will to power, which is as extensive as nature itself in the broadest possible sense, yeah? But it is an expression which is an active, affirmative expression, which does not, which, let's say, creates new living possibilities. It creates the new. Yeah? It creates a new possibility for life. This is going to be, again, by way of a kind of indirect answer to Maimon and Maimon's criticism of Kant. Yeah? So Maimon's going to say, how does the new come out of Kant? How can it possibly come out? We've got the conditions of possible experience. There's no other possibilities of experience, so that's it, right? So Maimon's going to say, well, no, we're going to go deeper, and Deleuze is going to say, yeah, we can kind of extend this criticism of Maimon through Nietzsche to show the way in which thought is equivalent to being, but only when being is equivalent to becoming, yeah? Which is, of course, the great Nietzschean equation, which is going to be so important for Deleuze throughout his entire trajectory. Being equals becoming. Okay, so not only then do we have this kind of cosmic vitalism, the cosmic animal, whatever it is, there are various, lots and lots of different terms that are associated with it, this kind of thought of overcoming, it's not human, it's not really subjective. Deleuze is going to call it pre-subjective, non-subjective. He's going to call it inorganic life. There are lots of different terms that will come up as we go along. It is, on the one hand, this kind of most cosmic conception of thought and life, that it is an expression of a kind of living nature which is constantly in the process of reinventing itself. But at the same time, it's also, and we're going to feel this very, very strongly when we come to Spinoza, at the same time as it's this very, very cosmic vision, it's also an utterly practical vision. In other words, it's about us. It's about what we do. And you can't read Nietzsche, you can't read Spinoza, and I would say you can't really read Deleuze without also reflecting on this element that It's the subtitle of one of the books Deleuze writes about Spinoza, Practical Philosophy. It's a practical philosophy because it's about what we do. Yeah? It's about how we live. It's about the kind of life that we have. Deleuze puts it like this. This is the next quotation. Evaluations, in essence, are not values but ways of being, modes of existence of those who judge and evaluate, serving as principles for the values on the basis of which they judge. This is why we always have the beliefs, feelings, and thoughts that we deserve given our way of being or our style of life. I mean, I remember very much when I first started to read Deleuze Guattari, I'd been reading a lot of Derrida, Lacan, and sort of the French thinkers and so forth and so on. And then I read Deleuze and Guattari, and I had this incredible experience that was completely new for me, which was I was reading a book of philosophy, but I had the feeling like they were talking about my life. And this was something completely new. This was something that I'd never experienced reading Lacan or Derrida. It was an intellectual exercise. I was fascinated by how complicated it was, and I wanted to try to work out what's that? You know, but it was very abstract. You know, it was a kind of it was a project of a student. Then Deleuze and Guattari, yeah, okay. So then I'm thinking, okay, they're really talking. They're not talking about my mark. Or whatever, they're talking about what I'm doing in my life. And that was a very important moment. So I think this is a very obvious element of Deleuze and Guattari's work, and that this is perhaps you could call the ethical side of their work, which obviously is very central, especially the centrality of Spinoza. His most important book is called The Ethics. It's about a way of living. So it's ontology, yes, but it's ethics as well. Ethics and ontology, in this kind of Nietzschean sense, cannot be separated because being is precisely a way of being. Yeah. All right. The affirmation of active forces, the affirmation that is of will to power, leads to the joy of overcoming and creation. The negation of will to power leads to resentment and the pettiness of the base human emotions, fear, sadness, lies, and servility. We shouldn't imagine, however, that active life is going to be any easier than reactive life, because, of course, anybody who's reading Nietzsche knows that, it's not easy being the overman. So it hurts, yeah. It's painful, it's lonely, yeah, it's very discouraging, and there are moments of exhilaration and perhaps success, but these are interspersed with long periods of sickness and recovery and so forth and so on. Nietzsche's own biography is just a kind of embodiment of his philosophy as well. So there is a tendency amongst some Deleuzian people to read this idea as being a very kind of, it's really nice, yeah? It's like we can affirm everything, and everything's so good, and everything's great, and it's cool, and good, and wonderful, and fantastic, wow! Yeah? And, there's various different versions of that, ranging from a kind of very banal one through to the kind of Bataille version of, limit experience and so forth and so on. The liberation of desire, it's just got to be, dancing in the daisies and having some group sex, right? But this is not really how it's going in Deleuze and Guattari if you look a little bit more carefully. So this is exactly this question of pain, this question of the difficulty of just having a single idea that hasn't sort of been before, that this is going to require a kind of level of training and commitment, a kind of level of seriousness that hardly anyone is going to be able to achieve. So we shouldn't just think that all we have to do is kind of don't worry, be happy. That's not really the appropriate metaphor for Deleuze and Guattari, although some people seem to think it might be. All right. Okay, so we must try to escape our own nihilism in order to find an active expression of will to power, in order to discover within us the overman, or as Nietzsche also calls him, Dionysus. This is finally the very practical meaning of immanent critique for Nietzsche and Deleuze. This is a kind of Nietzschean version now of the Kantian critique. Okay, the eternal return on Deleuze's reading, we must remember that Nietzsche's own very brief comments on the eternal return in Zarathustra and the Gay Science are very ambiguous. Nietzsche's reading of the eternal return is as the moment when the differential forces making up all of existence produce an affirmation that overcomes their existing relations and creates something truly new, something that projects us into a new mode of being beyond the human, a mode of being which is becoming. So the eternal return is this moment where will to power is able to affirm itself to the point in which there is a kind of, the point at which an overcoming is produced or unleashed by which something new comes into the world. Now, again, as I said before, we have to understand that something new means that it hasn't been before. But what it means is not that it comes out of nowhere. It's not a creation out of nothing. Yeah? It's a creation out of what has gone before, but only through the mechanism of an evaluation and interpretation which has been strong enough to be able to produce this overcoming. Yeah? It's only through, let's say, the training of Zarathustra, yeah, the years and years and years he spends in the mountains, you know, as a kind of a recluse, yeah, it's only this which is able to finally produce such an event. Yeah? Now, this is also another interesting example of Deleuze's ventriloquism, because Nietzsche always emphasizes that, this is exactly what's ambiguous about it, he always emphasizes that it is the return of the same that occurs in the eternal return. So there are various versions of that, but it's always, the eternal return is always, Nietzsche says, the return of the same. So it's difficult to imagine how Deleuze gets from that to understanding the eternal return as being this kind of cosmic birth, this kind of emergence of something new. But, of course, Deleuze doesn't let any minor details of the text distract him from what he thinks it means. And he explains this. It's the next quotation in the list. The eternal return is a force of affirmation, but it affirms everything of the multiple, everything of the different, everything of chance, except what subordinates them to the one, to the same, to necessity, everything except the one, the same, and the necessary. As a result, the eternal return is a kind of paradox by which Nietzsche's eternal return of the same means, according to Deleuze, and this is the next quotation, the same and the similar are indistinguishable from the eternal return itself. They do not exist prior to the eternal return. It is not the same or the similar which returns, but the eternal return, which is the only same and the only resemblance of that which returns. Nor can they be abstracted from the eternal return in order to react upon the cause. The same is said of that which differs and remains different. The eternal return is the same of the different, the one of the multiple, the resemblant of the dissimilar. So, the only thing that is, what is the same, the eternal return of the same, it means that what is the same in what returns is the different. Okay, so it's a kind of a funny little twist that Deleuze puts on Nietzsche. It's not, I'm not trying to say that it's inconsistent with Nietzsche. I don't think it's inconsistent with Nietzsche. But it's interesting just as an example of the way that Deleuze is quite happy, let's say, to produce a, shall we call it, forceful interpretation of the text that he's examining. It's always an interested interpretation. And in the end, yeah, you can, if you like, you can say, okay, I don't like that. You know, that's not so nice. But in the end, you know, Deleuze is only doing what his philosophy, in fact, suggests. So, of course, it's an interested interpretation. That's the point. Yeah? That's the whole point of the world of power and the way that it operates. That's the whole point of the ontology in the first place, is that it's an ontology of overcoming. It's an ontology of creation. So if you're going to read a text, then anyway, to imagine that you're going to be objective and simply tell it how it is, this is all, according to Deleuze and Nietzsche, a complete load of shit. That's not even possible in the first place. So, you know, why bother? That's ontologically impossible. If it's not impossible, then anyway, it's extremely disturbed, you know, that you should even want to do that, right? So it's, again, it has this kind of very practical slant. It's unapologetic. He doesn't apologize for giving an interested reading. He says, well, that's the point. Huh? That's what we're trying to do here. We're trying to create something new. We want, as one book very famously was called, a new Nietzsche. Yeah? We're sick of the old one. It's boring. You know, it's all horribly connected to the Nazis and all that, you know, awful stuff. So, okay, so we're going to have a new Nietzsche. We're going to have a different Nietzsche. This is, of course, very French, right? You have to understand. This is only possible in France. You can't do this in Germany. It's a geo-philosophy. It's very important. It's a very important element, that you have to remember. It's the same thing with the French interpretation of Heidegger, that is going to lead through to phenomenology and, you know, very important figures, Merleau-Ponty and so forth and so on. It's only possible in France. It's only possible in France that they can just sort of forget that Heidegger was a Nazi. You know? So nobody else is really going to be able to do that. So, you know, and of course, it's not to say that Nietzsche was a Nazi. It's just to say that from the distance of France, perhaps it's possible to, let's say, not exactly forget, but let's say step over this association that he had with National Socialism. Okay, the consequences of this period of the eternal return radical means that all forms, all conditions of possible experience are dissolved in the eternal return. Because it is the affirmation of the active force of will to power, the eternal return cannot tolerate any ground of what is. Everything that is in the eternal return is becoming, change, metamorphosis. This means there is no possible distinction between the true and the false, between an essence and its representation, between a condition and its and what it conditions. And as a result, as Nietzsche writes in Twilight of the Idols, the real world becomes a myth. Now, I was going to read this with you, but I don't think there's enough time. But it's in the reader. It's just one page. It comes from the Twilight of the Idols. And it's very important for Deleuze because it's going to give the conditions of two things in Deleuze's work which are important for us in terms of aesthetics. One is the concept of the simulacrum, which is an early concept that culminates in what is in difference in repetition and logic of sense, and which then more or less falls out of Deleuze's vocabulary. But nevertheless, we could say its kind of concept continues, particularly in the cinema books, where Deleuze in the second book calls on Nietzsche and the powers of the false to discuss documentary cinema. The basic idea is that if you have this kind of entolium and ontology, you have a will to power which is producing itself, yeah, in a kind of undetermined sense, then really there is no ground upon which it might be possible to distinguish between a real world and, or an essence and its representation. That there is no way to determine what the difference might be between something real and something's appearance. Yeah? This is exactly, of course, the point that I've been trying to make about the virtue and the actual, is that you can't ever distinguish them. Real conditions, real experience. It's that you cannot condition, you cannot distinguish the conditioned from the conditions, in the same way that you cannot, for Nietzsche, distinguish the real world from its appearance. So this is obviously going to have important consequences for any theory of art. It's going to have important consequences especially for any kind of theory of art, which, not just theory of art, any kind of theory of philosophy, Deleuze is going to say, that depends upon the concept, the structure of representation. That's going to be, according to Deleuze, almost all philosophy. And it's going to be, we could probably say, just about all of art. So it's going to mean a pretty big change, not just for the way that we think about art, but the way we think about philosophy as well. This is a whole another bit of it that I'm not really going to go into, but for those of you who are interested, Difference in Repetition, Chapter 3, the Image of Thought. This is precisely where Deleuze tries to show how the history of philosophy is dominated by a model of representation, and that it's exactly this model that has to be gone beyond. And Nietzsche is one of the, especially a Difference in Repetition, Nietzsche is the crucial figure which is going to allow him to go beyond a philosophy of representation. Okay, art doesn't, in this way of thinking, represent anything. It expresses genetic forces. It affirms them or negates them. And the question of art is not whether it accurately represents something that is outside of it, whether that something is a thing or an idea. Rather, the question of art is what forces it actualizes in its perspective and whether it affirms or negates these forces. Now, there's a lot to be said here, of course. You know, when we're talking about representational art, we're not just talking about a picture of a person or a picture of a landscape, okay? Because obviously there are some very elaborate theories of abstraction which are also representational, except that they turn colours into signifiers for, let's say, emotions. That would be Kandinsky on the spiritual and art. So each colour, this is the so-called theosophist tradition of abstract painting. Each colour is regarded as being a kind, having a kind of linguistic value in as much as it signifies an emotional content. Yeah? So this would be an example of a theory of abstraction that remained representational. So even though the abstract painting doesn't actually represent something out there, it just represents something in here. Yeah? A kind of spiritual realm. You can also argue that Malevich and spiritualism had similar ambitions, and so forth and so on. So when we're talking about a representational model of art, we're not just talking about, you know, a picture of something. We're, well, in that traditional sense, for a portrait or a landscape, we're also talking about more modern forms of art. And the other thing that we're moving towards now as well, which is going to be something that I'll try and talk more as we go along, is this very classical kind of, it's a certain type of, well, I was going to say avant-gardist idea, I'm not sure if that's quite correct, but under this idea of Nietzsche's of interpretation, it means that, in effect, the artistic moment, if you like, is no longer the moment of creation, is no longer the moment at which the artist makes the artwork. It is the moment at which we interpret the artwork. Yeah? So in other words, everybody has become artists. And this is a very modern concept. Some people would date it to Duchamp. It's maybe not necessarily so easily dated to Duchamp. There were similar ideas floating around in various places, including the Russian Revolution, constructivism, and so forth and so on. But anyway, we can say for sure it's a kind of modern position, that the aesthetic moment is not going to be analysed in the relationship between artist and artwork, except to the extent that, in effect, everybody in their relationship to an artwork as an artist, because the interpretation is creative. You know? All right. I want to just before I finish, we're almost out of time, unfortunately, because there's a lot of things I haven't had time to say. But I would just like to try and say a little bit about Romanticism, because I kind of promised at the beginning that I would. So this idea of interpretation, evaluation, this leads to another one of Nietzsche's very famous concepts, which is genealogy. Of course, genealogy of morals being the most obvious example. This is also the element of Nietzsche which is so important for Foucault. So it's this idea that any kind of historical reading is not simply a reading of a historical process of cause and effect, but is itself a process of creation. So that when you produce a history of moral or morality or values, you actually, you know, are in the process of creating new values or a new version, yeah, of history. That history does not exist in itself, it only exists in the process of its construction. Yeah? And that's obviously what Deleuze is doing in the way that he reads the history of philosophy as well, is that his reading is also a creation, and this is precisely what Nietzsche means by genealogy. It's a critical method which is no longer outside what it critiques, a critical method which does not simply discover values, but creates them. Any mode of thought that posits something outside of this imminent genealogical process is reactive, in Nietzsche's terms, because it sets up something that cannot change, that cannot overcome itself. Something real, in other words. Yeah? Something true, in other words, we should say true. Two of Nietzsche's most hated enemies in this respect are Christianity and science. This may seem like an odd combination, especially as science is generally materialist and so atheist, but this is not the point for Nietzsche, who sees both Christianity and science setting up truth outside of life as an absolute and unchanging value, or, as Nietzsche calls it, an ascetic ideal. The ascetic is the one who denies the body, and for Nietzsche to deny the body is to deny life. For Nietzsche, ascetic ideals are an example of what he calls life against life. So inasmuch as Kant remains committed to ideas and things in themselves that remain outside of experience, Nietzsche regards Kant as, this is a quotation from Twilights of the Idols, he regards Kant as a cunning Christian. That's what he calls him, a cunning Christian, kind of a tricky Christian. In this sense, Nietzsche accuses Kant of succumbing to the very German problem of romanticism, which he sees as a commitment to a beyond, which is, finally, nothing less than a philosophical form of Christianity, a sick negation of life as will to power. Nietzsche writes, German philosophy as a whole, Leibniz, Kant, Hegel, Schopenhauer, to name the greatest, is the most fundamental form of romanticism and homesickness there has ever been. Because again, there's a lot of things to be said here. This is a kind of a classic Nietzschean remark, okay? Leibniz, Kant, Hegel, Schopenhauer, it's all crap. It's just romanticism, rubbish, forget it, yeah? And it's funny because I was once talking to a very old but sort of eminent professor of philosophy from Munich. And I said to him, oh, you know what, I love Nietzsche, it's so fresh, you know, he just says these crazy things, he just says, that's crap, that's good, you know, like that. And this professor said to me, I always remember it, he said, yeah, it's easy to sound intelligent when you don't know what you're talking about. Yeah. So this is always the thing with Nietzsche that people say, is that, well, how much did he really know, you know, about what he's talking about, and this being this sort of never-ending industry of people trying to find out, like, did Nietzsche read this, and did Nietzsche read that, and then all of a sudden, we found out that he read some very obscure Hindu manuscript, and this explains everything, you know, and so it goes on. And, I mean, it's kind of, you know, fun to do this kind of work, but in the end, a little bit to the side of what we're doing. Okay, so the point is romanticism. He means it here in the sense simply, and maybe this is why I always remember the professor from Munich's remark, because there certainly is some truth to it. So he means it in the sense that they establish something outside of life which is the aim of life. Yeah, so whether this is the aim that we are attempting to discover that lies kind of at the bottom of life, but nevertheless as part of life, but which we have somehow become distanced from, that we've become alienated from it, yeah, and that we have to try and find our way back to it. Now, it's very clever what Nietzsche says here, because this is, in a way, the fundamental motif of romanticism, yeah, Sehnsucht, yeah. This is the isolated, lonely individual who has been alienated from their society, but it is precisely this alienation which will allow them to discover something more, something real and beating and alive, that somehow is the center of, but also the reason for, the universe itself. Nature. Yeah, this is going to be the romantic fascination with nature philosophy. Yeah? This attempt to try and discover this kind of natural principle. Yeah? But the only way that we can do it, and in a way, Nietzsche is exactly the example of this, is through this kind of withdrawal, through this alienation, through this longing. We have this longing for finding the truth of life. But somehow we can never quite get to it. Yeah? We can never find it. This is a typical Hegelian motif as well. This eternal alienation. Every time we think we find it, then there's always another negation which sends us away from it. So it's this constant, never-ending process. So Nietzsche sees this as being the kind of motif for German idealism. And in actual fact, he's going to include himself in that tradition, because he writes in the second preface to The Birth of Tragedy, his first book, he writes a kind of very strong self-critique and says, this book is somehow, I like parts of it, I like the stuff about Dionysus and all the rest of it, but in the end, it's basically still romantic, yeah, and that's its real problem. And of course, it has to do with the fact that when he writes Birth and Tragedy, he's still under the influence of Wagner and the whole German romantic tradition, which he then breaks with shortly after the Birth of Tragedy, and after that point, his work is going to follow a quite different trajectory, no longer in this kind of romantic tradition. So Nietzsche concludes, romantic art is only a makeshift substitute for a defective reality. So this is going to be the way that Deleuze, Guattari are going to use Nietzsche to kind of separate the concept of the sublime that is found in Kant from its romantic trajectory. Okay, so that the sublime is an experience that goes beyond human experience, or beyond the conditions of possible human experience, but it is no longer romantic in the way that it is in Kant, because it does not open out onto another world. It does not open out onto the real world of the ideas, or the transcendental world of the ideas, the true ideas that, according to Kant, the sublime reveals to us. So the sublime instead is going to become a kind of Nietzschean, Dionysian concept. It's going to be beyond the limits of possible human experience, but this beyond is not the true world, the real world, as opposed to its appearance. It is instead the world of will to power, the world creating itself. Okay, I think that's all we've got time for. Any questions? All right, next week, Spinoza.